She's a pro-choice, liberal, feminazi slut Rush Limbaugh warned you about. It's Start Me Up.
Start Me Up.
With Kimberly A. Johnson.
Happy Wednesday. It is the, what is it, the 21st of, 22nd of February. I don't even know the date. Anyway, today I've got an interesting guest. Her name is Eileen Davis, and we're going to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment. But I want to kind of like preface this with the idea that every single time I write an article about the Equal Rights Amendment, it's like trying to pull teeth to get people to read it. And, you know, I mean, obviously you've got your diehard fans who are going to read it and share it and everything. But just like with climate change, I don't know, it's really tough getting people to care about the subject. And part of the reason is because a lot of voters out there don't understand what the Equal Rights Amendment is and that women are not constitutionally protected in the United States of America. So many of us think that, you know, I thought, you know, in 2012, I was under the impression that women had constitutional protection against gender discrimination, but we do not. And we need it. So I wanted to have Eileen on because she's a bit of a wonk. And she's got, you know, this is like her passion. And she spends her days going to elected officials' offices and giving them information and begging and pleading with them to, you know, consider removing the expired deadline, which we will discuss in our conversation. And she works tirelessly for the ERA to be ratified. And to get people interested and excited about this is so hard because not only do people already think that we have it, there are so many naysayers out there that I think they kind of drown out the truth of the fact that we need it. So we're going to address some of those naysayers and their, you know, who claim that we don't need it because we already have the Equal Pay Act or because we have the 14th Amendment. None of those things are working to protect women or men from gender discrimination. So Eileen's going to cover some of those things, and she's got a lot to say. So if you're interested in the subject at all, maybe take some notes. Because when you do post about it online, I guarantee you you're gonna get those comments from people, you know, oh, sweetie, what are you bitching and complaining about? Why do you hate men? Blah, 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 blah. So real briefly, Eileen is the co-founder of womenmatter.org, and it's women-matter.org. And it's dedicated to ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment and the CEDAW Treaty, which we will explain in our conversation. She is a graduate of Emerge, America Leadership Program, and she is a former nurse, clinician, adjunct professor, and a lifelong social justice advocate. So again, her website is women, that's with an E, women-matter.org. Her website is filled with all kinds of information, answering questions, and anything she's discussed here on the show later is probably going to be on her website. So you can take a look at that. And so I'm going to have her on now, and we're going to talk about the ERA. But before we do, I'm going to ask you to support me and my show. And you can become a monthly subscriber, and you can really subscribe. You can donate or subscribe with any amount, a dollar. If you pledge $5 a month, you're going to hear the and another thing, which is what I do after my free show. And then if you pledge $10 a month, you get access to the special bonus show. And, you know, sometimes I have a guest on that show, sometimes I don't. But, you know, I'm an indie podcaster, so I'm asking for your support. Anyway, without further ado, here comes Eileen. Welcome, Eileen.
Hi, Kimberly.
I'm so glad that you're here today to talk to everybody. As I explained earlier, You're kind of like a mentor to me in...
I'm sorry, I'm kind of what? You're breaking up.
You're kind of like a mentor to me regarding the ERA, because when I first realized that it had never been ratified into the Constitution, you know, and I started doing articles on it, somehow we became friends, and you're kind of like my go-to person when I have a question. You're like the ERA encyclopedia, so thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
So let's just dive in. And I'm going to let you pretty much steer the conversation, or at least, you know, take over with the facts and stuff, since you are aware. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions, but let's just start off with a real brief explanation, description of what the Equal Rights Amendment is.
Well, the Equal Rights Amendment is the companion amendment to the 19th Amendment. And that's an important thing to remember. When Alice Paul fought for the 19th Amendment, which is the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any other state on account of sex, she also proffered what she thought was going to be the 20th Amendment. And that amendment says equality of rights shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any other state. And it's and I say that because it's interesting to note that it's the exact same wording with the switch out of three words, the right to vote being replaced with the equality of rights. That's important because in 2017, people are saying that they find the wording of the amendment to be very ambiguous and open to interpretation, which is kind of strange because the 19th Amendment has stood the test of time for 100 years with an exact same wording. So it speaks to the insincerity of some of the arguments that we have. Mm-hmm. But that is the Equal Rights Amendment. And when Alice Paul put it out, it's like any other thing in your life. You have a big project to do. You know, you have to do something. You're rehabbing a kitchen or something. You do the most important thing first, and then you do the rest of it later.
Right.
Well, she felt that the most important thing was to franchise the vote for women, which of course extends to everyone. And we'll talk about how the Equal Rights Amendment helps everybody. As the cake is baked, it benefits women the most, but there are overlaps to men, and we'll talk about that. But she went ahead and franchised the vote and then thought that she was going to bring equality in as the part B. She actually thought the Equal Rights Amendment was going to be the 20th Amendment. And 100 years later, we still don't have it. And that is our national shame.
It is. And then, okay, so then there's also the Women's Treaty, the International Women's Treaty, CEDAW. That's CEDAW. So explain briefly what that is.
Well, CEDAW Treaty is the Council for the Elimination of Discrimination Against All Women. And that is a part of the UN. And the interesting thing is there are only five countries that have not signed the CEDAW Treaty around the world. And they are Iran, Palau, Tobago, Tonga, Somalia, and the United States. Hmm. I mean, Afghanistan has signed the CEDAW Treaty. And the interesting thing is that the Equal Rights Amendment is the reason why we haven't signed the CEDAW Treaty. Because the every country since World War II who has put a constitution in, including Afghanistan, we, the United States, have made them include an equal rights amendment for all persons, regardless of gender, in their country's constitutions. Mm-hmm. And we ourselves don't have one, which is very, very interesting. Now, Afghanistan ignores their equality clause in their constitution. You know, China ignores their, you know, they have a constitution they choose to ignore. We have a constitution that we, you know, take very seriously, but we also cherry pick what's in it.
Yeah.
So it undermines our international higher moral ground. I mean, we're like the drunk uncle at Thanksgiving who tells you how you should run your life, and everybody sits there and rolls their eyes because who's he to talk? I mean, that's what we're doing internationally. We're really, really affecting our international gravitas.
And so basically the idea is if we were to ratify CEDAW, then we would have to, within a year's time, ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And are you aware of what are the implications if we do not do that? Are we in violation? And if so, what does that mean?
Well, we're not in violation of a treaty we haven't signed.
Well, if we did.
Of the treaty, if we chose to sign it, it would require an equal rights amendment, which comes up to two things. Number one, it's a backdoor way of getting the Equal Rights Amendment done, because signing the CEDAW treaty only requires Senate majority, simple Senate majority, whereas finishing a constitutional amendment is a very laborious process, which we've all learned. But the thing is that it also tells us what is the intrinsic resistance, because you think to yourself, why would the United States not sign such a thing? Because within our own country, we would have to have the Equal Rights Amendment. And there are a lot of forces within this country, for reasons that probably the hardest part of this journey for me is understanding the resistance. Mm-hmm. But the resistance is very real.
Right. And so now with the Equal Rights Amendment, it was penned in 1923, correct?
Yes. And then it languished and languished and languished and languished. I call us today the fourth wave feminists, because the first wave feminists was the Elizabeth Cady Stanton in 1848, who wrote the Declaration of the Sentiment. The second wave feminist was the 1923 right to vote, Alice Paul, let's get the 20th Amendment, make that the Equal Rights Amendment. Third wave feminists were it was in 1972 when that same Alice Paul amendment was brushed off, dusted off, and put into Congress and passed and started on the road to ratification. And the fourth wave feminists are us, who are now picking up the mantle and trying to finish what's been going on for so incredibly long a time.
So in the 70s, during the women's revolution, women's rights revolution, I guess, we were able to ratify 35 of the 38 states. And then this really awesome woman named Phyllis Schlafly came along and killed it. And now she's dead. And if we ever do ratify it, she's not going to be alive to see that, which really pisses me off.
Well, odd people are back, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But in 1972, and this is going to get a little wonky, but it requires an explanation. It's important to remember that the Equal Rights Amendment started out as a Republican bill.
Yes.
Alice Paul was a Republican. It was championed by Republicans. It was put in by Republicans in every Congress since 1923 and largely ignored. But like so many things, the Southern strategy, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have somehow flipped, which is a cautionary tale that if you really want to have rights in your government that can never be changed, the Constitution is the place to put them, because generational whims change who's who and what's what, and the laws come and the laws go.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, getting back on point, in 1972, it passed Congress with enormous bipartisan support, sponsored by Republicans, and it passed overwhelmingly. And in the resolving clause, not even in the face of the amendment itself that Congress voted on, Democratic Congressman Sam Irwin, the same guy who did Watergate, put in a poison pill of a ratification deadline. And he said at the time that it was folly to think that men and women should be treated equally. So he was very much against it, called himself a Southern gentleman. And he felt that women needed to be, protected and whatever, let's just say equality. He thought equality was folly. That's what he called it, folly.
Right.
So he put a ratification deadline on it in an attempt to poison it. And the interesting thing is, we only put ratification deadlines on things we want to kill. And the other thing that was poison pilled, because they had used the North Carolina had used the poison pill of a ratification deadline before, and they used it on the 24th Amendment, which was the poll tax, because again, they wanted to stop the poll tax amendment of saying you can't. It was a very open, bold way to do voting restriction. People had to guess how many pennies were in a jar. They had to answer mm-hmm. questions that people with 3 degrees couldn't answer. They had to pay money they didn't have. Anyway, the 24th Amendment, they put a ratification deadline on that as well. And they did that with the Equal Rights Amendment. And then it sailed through 35 states. And then literally sailed. And then the Eagle Forum, which was the beginning of the conservative fundamentalist movement we see today, came in. And Phyllis Schlafly, who I can't even say her name without choking, her group is still alive today. And it's interesting because they have now popped up in Nevada, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
Hmm.
They started a fear-mongering campaign that that the Equal Rights Amendment was going to make women kill their children, literally. They would kill, they would make women murder their children, divorce their husbands, become lesbians, lose their femininity, be put in combat, have to share combat living quarters with men, single-sex bathrooms. You know, it was just going to be this dystopian nightmare for women, and, you know, rape and pillage and all of that. And they scared people to death, and they got the Republican Party to run away from the Equal Rights Amendment, because that's when they were deciding. And there's some great video out there about how the Republican Party decided to co-opt the fundamentalist Christian movement. The bottom line is the resistance of people like Phyllis Schlafly, which remains today, is a fundamentalist conservative view of the Bible. If I might, I'm just going to put that out there. I've heard all these excuses. They try to blame it on the ratification deadline, which is a specious, silly argument. They try to say we don't need it anymore, which are the same people who every other word is the C word. They're constitutionists and constitution that. But when you tell them you want to be in the Constitution, oh, that's silly. You don't need that anymore. Well, when did the Constitution become irrelevant? When did the Constitution become not needed anymore? You know, did we miss the memo? So all of the arguments just are circular, and they try to avoid what really is their concern. And their concern is a fundamental understanding that the Bible says that women – are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. My screen just went black. It's a fundamental belief that the Bible, as they interpret the Bible, says that women are secondary to men, subjective to men, inferior to men, that women are rib meat, if you will, and that they don't want their constitution to grant equality that they don't see in their Bible. That is the absolute crux of this issue. Hmm. That is the fundamental. And I've had many an argument with a conservative elected official who tries to turn the minutia of some legal technicality into a wall to hide behind. And then when I devolve it, sooner or later they say, oh, well, I'm concerned about the family. I'm concerned about women in clergy, like they don't understand separation of church and state. I don't know. But it always ends up being a women don't know their place argument. If you let them talk long enough, they always show their hand. The cards come face up.
And then so now we got the 35 states and then fell short of the three that we needed.
Right.
The expiration, the deadline expired, and that was that. So,
well, not so quick.
Okay.
Not so quick. We had a 7-year ratification deadline, but President Carter was able to get Congress to extend it for 3 years,
okay,
which is an important point of law because it proves that Congress has extended the deadline once before, so can
okay.
do it again.
Okay. That's a good point, and I didn't know
that. Because there's precedent. And it because they wanted to just try to finish it, but they mounted such a fear-mongering campaign, which was ridiculous. And every generation has looked back on the generation behind it and has basically thought the reasons were ridiculous. In the 1920s, it was, you got the right to vote, you women are never happy. And then it was petticoat rule. They were afraid of petticoat rule, which is interesting.
What's petticoat rule?
Petticoat rule is the idea that the women were going to be taken over, that the women were going to be in charge, and that it was an unnatural state of being for women to be in decision making. Women were, that it was basically, petticoat rule was basically the fear of emasculation by the men power structure.
Oh my God, they're so
and if
afraid.
Women had a seat at the table, they would, the petticoats would be making all the decisions. Mm-hmm. And that was then, they called it petticoat rule.
Wow. Well, and I think the fear mongering though worked in the 1970s because we were so we were still so close to that 1950s lifestyle. There were still a lot of women who were born thinking that they were inferior or they were happy. They were afraid of equality because it meant that they might have to take more responsibility. And the way that I would even address those women is like, that's the whole point of equality is you get to choose which lifestyle you want to live instead of being dictated
that you have to.
Yeah.
Women say, I don't want equality. I said, well, equality is like voting rights.
Right.
You know, what makes you vote.
Right.
But I want my equality. If we have equality and you don't want to exercise it, that's your problem. I don't care.
That's your nightmare.
That's your nightmare, sweetheart. If you don't want to vote, then don't vote, but live with the consequences. You don't want to be equal, then don't be equal, but live with the consequences. If I want to be equal and it doesn't work out well for me, I'll live with the consequences.
Right. And the thing about the Equal Rights Amendment is that it's basically protection against gender discrimination. So it's not like the woman's amendment. It's a gender, no. It just basically gives you that protection against discrimination.
There are reasons why the Equal Rights Amendment helps men as well. And as the cake is baked, women have the most to gain from an Equal Rights Amendment, because it was originally written to exclude women. The Constitution did not include women. The 14th Amendment does not include women. As a matter of fact, at the time, the abolitionists are the one that fought for the 14th Amendment, and they wanted to have women in there, and they had to pull women out because it was a deal breaker. And anybody who saw the movie Lincoln, filmed right here in Richmond, Virginia at the State House, when they said, what's next? You know, rights for women. I mean, it was a bridge too far. So women were thrown under the bus to franchise full equality and the right to vote for black men. And that's an important point as well, which is what I say when I'm talking to diverse intersectional communities, because this is not just a white woman's problem. Actually, the Equal Rights Amendment is more of an issue for women of color, because they're more likely to suffer from the intersectionality of gender discrimination and racial discrimination. And that's a double slam, which is why women of color earn less, have more pay inequity than white women do. Right. But think about this. You had women who were in servitude slavery for hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, bearing children because their slave owner would have sex with them, you know, living and being beaten and having short life, and all of the atrocities that every slave, male or female, but when they went and freed the slaves and gave rights to the slaves, they used the word slaves like they were including everyone, but really the only ones they freed and brought into full citizenship were the males. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment conveyed rights to freed black male slaves. Mm-hmm. All women of all color stayed in their pink jail, if you will. And right. I don't mean to be harsh, but that's how they were separated. They were over in the girl island, and that's right. where they stayed.
No, feel free to be harsh. And because I'm fucking sick of this shit.
Because I'm not angry. I'm very frustrated by the lack of understanding that people have on this issue. But I'm not angry. I don't hate men. I'm not a emasculating bitch. I just that's okay. You can. I'm just
teasing you.
I've been married for 40 years. I love my husband.
I know, and your husband is a total feminist.
Oh yes, and he's a big 6'6", 220-pound. Retired federal law enforcement officer. Wow. And we love our good men and we love our good feminists because nothing says, you know, you have nothing to be afraid of than a man like my husband. You know, a man of quality is not threatened by equality.
Exactly.
And that is an important point. And my husband just standing next to me is a poster for you got nothing to worry about and everything to gain.
Well, and, what was I just going to say? You threw me off. Going back to the hating men. You know, I am angry. I mean, I'm not the stereotypical angry feminist that the opposition wants to paint me out to be. But yeah, I'm angry because I don't understand how this is that, you know, the two things that represent equality for women, which is feminism and the Equal Rights Amendment, have been dragged through the mud for so long, and we've allowed it to happen. And I think that is because the lack of education and obviously which leads to a complete lack of understanding. And the idea that, you know, so many people living today in the United States believe that we already are equal, and they don't really realize that we're not, and they don't understand. And so unfortunately the loud voices of the right, you know, continue to dominate and, you know, and it just, that pisses me off. So that makes me angry. Anyway, doesn't mean I'm a man hater. It just means that I'm pissed off that we don't have what we should, that should have been our birthright.
Again, let me go back to that. First of all, I'm going to throw this out there and then I'm going to back up a little bit. I'm more angry at other women than I am at men.
Me too.
That's my point. But my point of law that I want to make is that in the world of law, you have constitution is constitutional strict scrutiny. It is inviolable volatile. I'm always miss that word up, but it is an inviolable, unequivocal, enshrined protection. And in legal terms, it's called strict scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Then you have congressional laws and their intermediate scrutiny. So when somebody violates a law and it goes through the courts, they look at it from the lens of state law. Then they look at it through the lens of congressional law, like Title IX. And then if it goes all the way to the Supreme Court, they look through it through the level of strict scrutiny level law. And that's how they decide whether or not they're going to take a case. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that gender equality is not a strict scrutiny constitutional right. Mm-hmm. So when something like the Duke versus Walmart case gets to the Supreme Court, they can't take it on gender equality because gender equality is not a constitutional right. principle. This is important because there have been over 200 cases that the Supreme Court have not taken that were based on a gender equality violation because there is no gender equality violation enshrined in the United States Constitution. It would require a ratified Equal Rights Amendment. Yeah. Now, people say to me, oh, you're wrong. And I say, well, let's just quote Justice Scalia yeah. and Justice Ginsburg, depending upon your politics. You know, because you don't tell a conservative, you don't quote Ginsburg to a conservative because right. they basically tell you she's a liberal hack and they don't like her. But so I will be happy to quote Ginsburg and Scalia. And Scalia at the Hastings School of Law in 2008, I believe it was. It's interesting to remember that the Lilly Ledbetter Act is a congressional act. It's an intermediate law. But the reason that it's that, it's a consolation prize. Mm-hmm. All those intermediate laws, Title IX, Title VII, Equal Pay Act of 1963, which is useless and toothless. It does nothing. The VAWA, Violence Against Women Act. Every one of these laws, in order to be fully enforceable, need a constitutional principle to sit on. They mm-hmm. are sitting in a basket with no bottom, if you will, constitutionally. Mm-hmm. They are nails without a hammer, if you will. You can use any metaphor you want. They are a house without a basement. They are sitting on no constitutional principle. Now, it's interesting. We put the 14th Amendment in place, conveying rights to, civil rights to people of, freed slaves, et cetera, and then it took 100 years plus later to put the Intermediate Act of the Civil Rights Act into law, which then sat on the constitutional 14th Amendment. We've got all these intermediate laws, but we never put in the constitutional basis for those laws. So they are consolation prizes. Well, anyway, Lilly Ledbetter went to the Supreme Court with her original complaint. Same complaint. Went all the way to the Supreme Court and she was turned away. She was denied. And this is a point of law, but people don't really know this. And then Congress, and there was such an outcry at the time that they passed the Lilly Ledbetter Act as a consolation prize that the fact that she was turned away at the Supreme Court. Now, while I appreciate all these intermediate acts, the Lilly Ledbetter Act, the Title IX, they have actually confused things because they have been band-aids on a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. They are making people think the problem is solved and it's not. These are small fixes. It's like patching your roof and you just need a new roof. Mm-hmm. You just fix the roof already, get a roofer in here, do it right. And that's what the problem. But anyway, there was a law student at the Hastings School of Law who basically asked Justice Scalia how he could turn down Lilly Ledbetter's because he wrote the dissenting. Mm-hmm. He wrote the dissenting opinion. He wrote the opinion that turned her away. They were in the majority and he wrote the opinion. And she asked him, how could you do that? And he said, the question is not whether or not the Constitution requires discrimination based on gender. The question is whether or not the Constitution prohibits it. It doesn't. I was under no obligation to do so. And then he went on to say, that is the way the Constitution was written. That's the way the Constitution is. If you don't like that, there is a process for doing something about it. It's called changing the law. He basically was, said, get the constitutional amendment, but until we have it, we don't have it. Mm-hmm. And
so going back, he specifically said, highlight that part about the main gist of what he said.
the question is not whether or not the Constitution, and this is an absolute complete quote, it's on video. If you,
right.
If you ask Kamala Lopez for it, it's actually in the documentary Equal Means Equal, him saying these words.
Okay.
He's sitting on a podium, like, you know, one of those things in a chair, mm-hmm. you know, between two ferns, giving an interview in a school, law school, and taking questions from students in the audience. And he said, the question is not whether the Constitution requires discrimination based on gender. The question is whether it prohibits it. It doesn't.
There you go. It does not prohibit it.
It does not. And then he goes on to say, and I will paraphrase because I don't have the direct quote in front of me. That's what the laws are for. If you don't like it, change the laws. But that's the way the Constitution is. He's an originalist. What the Constitution says is what he did. It ain't there. You can't make it there. And if you want it to be there, go put it there. That's basically what he said.
So that brings us to the idea, since the expiration, there is a new movement to get those last three states, which is called the three-state strategy. And briefly explain what that's all about.
Well, it's not a new movement, but it feels like it's been going on forever. But the interesting thing is when the Equal Rights Amendment aged out in 1982, everybody just was like, oh my God, we can't believe this happened. What are we going to do? And then they thought they couldn't do anything. And they said, you know, the ratification deadline was, you know, made in nullity. That's the legal word, nullity. And then what happened, a couple of very interesting things happened. And there are different articles I can refer you to. One is a William & Mary article called Why the Equal Rights Amendment is Legally Impresentable and Viable Before the States. The other one is a University of Chicago Law School article that says why ratification deadlines are a violation of Article 5 of the Constitution. And briefly, what Article 5 of the Constitution calls for is parity in the amendment process, but it doesn't say a word about ratification deadlines. Mm-hmm. Ratification deadlines were an invention in the 20th century. They never occurred until the 20th century, and somebody thought they could just kind of do that. It's really just something they dreamed up. It's not in the Constitution. If you find the word ratification deadline in the Constitution, I'd like to see your copy. It isn't there. Look at Article 5. It isn't there. So the question is, they can't just add crap to the Constitution. They can't add crap to the process, but they did. So that is one question, that the ratification deadline in and of itself is questionably unconstitutional. The other one is that it calls for parity in the process. The third one is that there is precedent to ignore ratification deadlines as a states' rights issue. The interesting thing is, going back to the poll tax amendment, the 24th Amendment, the state of Virginia, which is where I reside, case in point, the movie Loving, which is about Virginia's miscegenation laws, Virginia always does the right thing, but it's always pretty much dead last in doing so. As it was with interracial marriage. It was illegal, and that's what the movie Loving is about. So what happened was the state of Virginia, but once they decide to get on the right side of history, they run and try to play catch up. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening. That's what happened with the 24th Amendment. They realized it was an absolute stain on Virginia that they never ratified the 24th Amendment, the poll tax amendment. So they went ahead and ratified it 7 years after the deadline was imposed. The General Assembly fully ratified the poll tax amendment, even though there was a deadline fully in place. It is now in the Commonwealth of Virginia records as a fully and complete ratification with no asterisks, with no exceptions, with nothing. They're claiming full and complete ratification. Having done that, and they stated at the time that it was a states' rights issue, that they had the right to do that. You know, I mean, Virginia fought a war over states' rights. Mm-hmm. So why can't they vote on something if they think they want to do it, right? So that's why they did it. Here we are, you know, 20 years later, and they're like, oh, oopsie, we can't do that. We need Congress's permission. We're like, no, you don't. No, you don't. But that's case in point number one. Case in point number two is that in 1993, and again, I don't mean to go out in the weeds. I mean, it's an interesting thing. The equality of rights shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any other state on account of sex is a 23-word amendment. It looks just like the 19th Amendment, which is one of the shortest amendments in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. But after 100 years of all this nonsense, it gets wrapped in a lot of dust and spider webs and a lot of gunk. There's a lot of schmutz on this thing. It doesn't belong there. But Having said that, in 1993, Congress passed the 27th Amendment, mm-hmm. the so-called Madison Amendment, so named because James Madison, yes, that James Madison, had entered the amendment 203 years later, mm-hmm. and it didn't pass the required two-thirds of the states until 1993. And it went in as a complete and total and full, unquestioned, unchallenged amendment. That amendment came up during the sequester because that's the amendment that says no matter what, Congress has to get its salary. So remember we had the sequestration?
Yes.
And all of these federal employees weren't getting paid. And they were like, well, we don't get mad at us. The Constitution says we have to take our salary because Congress people were, and senators were still getting paid. And they fell back on James Madison's amendment as their don't blame me, you know, I only work here. Strategy. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking responsibility that thousands and thousands and thousands. And that was a big deal in Virginia because we have a lot of federal employees who suddenly didn't get paid mm-hmm. for a month. So that was a huge deal here. But the 27th Amendment, so we said at the time, they said, wait a minute, flag on the field. You're telling us that our amendment is dead in the water after 10 years and you just passed an amendment. So that re-energized the movement in terms of questioning the parity of the process, all of that. And that's when all of this started in the examination, the legal examination. That's when the William & Mary legal thing was written, you know, why the Equal Rights Amendment remains legally inviolable and presentable before the states. That's when a lot of this resurgence, because then when legal scholars were getting involved and going, well, if they are going to do precedent of the Madison Amendment, that raises the question that the Equal Rights Amendment as a states' rights issue can proceed. So we re-energized the ability to get the remaining three states, Illinois, Virginia, and the third state has slipped around for a while. And it's interesting now that it looks like it's going to be Nevada, mm-hmm. only because, again, things change. Nevada has now had an election, and they're the only ones that had a really big different change in their electoral, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So what happened was, we set about a couple of different things. We set about going to the states that we thought were winnable, and we set about going to Congress and saying, you remove the ratification deadline once, you can do it again. Mm-hmm. And there are bills in Congress right now. And what I would say to your listeners that in California, one of the things that you can do is call every congressperson, Republican or Democrat, both senators, Republican or Democrat, if you have relatives living in another state, call them and call your congresspeople and your senators and tell them to sponsor these bills.
And sponsor isn't a vote. It's just a show of support.
No. It's sponsoring a bill to remove the ratification.
Okay. I was thinking in terms of the resolutions.
Well, No. There are bills in Congress to ask Congress to remove the ratification deadline.
Okay.
And one of them, the Congress version, is by your own California Jackie Speier.
Right.
She is the owner of that bill. Oh gosh, I don't have the number in front of me. Wait a minute, I think it's on my phone because I always have to refer to it, and I've got so many things rattling around in my head. Let me look under my notes.
Well, and just while you're looking, I mean, this is kind of where, I met you in the process of. Getting signatures for the three-state strategy, getting people to sign on and support, mm-hmm. because I injected myself. Somehow I met up with you and some other activists, and, you know, I talked about the fact that I wrote a blog and that I might be able to put pressure on some of the senators who were not signing on to that.
And you were one of the people that's under 45 that had no idea that this was actually a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's another thing. 95% of Americans think we should have equal rights in the Constitution. 72% think we already do. And if you're under 40, that number goes up.
Right. It's well, 30, I'm 40. I'm 48 now, but at the time I was 44 when I found out.
Right. And so our biggest problem today is a learning deficit.
Yeah.
And convincing, when you tell a 30-year-old that she is not in the Constitution. She looks at me like I'm crazy.
Exactly.
And there's a huge, because they get upset. Their first thing is denial. Like that can't be. Uh-huh. No, it can. And it is. And, so, you know, it's just, I can't find it, but I have it. Anyway, I will send it to you.
Well, there's like, I know, is it still the same numbers as like HJRES 15? Is it still?
No, it's, I think it's Senate Joint Resolution 5. See, that's the other thing. Every 2 years, Congress changes.
Yes. Yeah, so then we have to do new, introduce new resolutions.
It's like an etch-a-sketch. You got to shake it dry and start all over again. We're up to 165 sponsors since January 4th. But Jackie Spears is the House bill patron. Uh-huh. And you can add the number of the bill later, obviously.
Right.
And the Senate bill is Senator Cardin from Maryland.
Yeah, Ben Cardin.
Ben Cardin. And he sponsors it. And this has gone on now. Every session, but every session they have to write a new bill. They have to submit a new bill. So it's 5 steps forward and 3 steps back.
So let me ask you a question on this, because I think I might be a little confused here. With these mm-hmm. with these resolutions, we've got the support of signatures. So once, how many do we need? What is the process to get this voted, to get Congress to vote on it?
We have to have enough of them to bring it to the floor.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's so in a way, is it just a show of support? At this point, it's not a vote when you get somebody to sign on to the resolution?
Well, our problem is the Republicans won't sign on.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So we need Republicans to sign on.
Well, and the reason they should is because it's not even that I necessarily want this to happen in this way, but if under a Republican president, the Equal Rights Amendment is ratified, they could put that feather in their cap.
And winner, winner, chicken dinner, Kimberly.
Exactly.
I've been saying that in the gerrymandered conservative Republican community that are so upset that there's no war on women. I'm like, do you people not understand that I'm handing you?
Yes.
I like puppies, Bill.
Yeah, exactly.
You can do something that most Americans think is already in place and be completely bulletproof against any sign, any complaints of gender bias forever. Why are you not doing this?
Yeah.
Do you not realize they'll say to me, oh, this is only symbolic. We don't need to do that. I'm like, if it was symbolic, you would have done it already, because you would have crowed, thrown yourself a party, had a big press conference.
Yes, exactly.
Made a big deal out of it. You don't want to do it because it speaks to your intrinsic biases, mm-hmm. and you've got a lot of fundamentalists that are beating you up, that you're just, you know, the whole world is going to turn into some dystopian equality landscape if you do.
So now it looks like it's Nevada. So we've got Illinois and Virginia, and activists in those states are working on getting. Explain that.
Well, I've been in Virginia. I'm full disclosure. I moved down I moved here 25 years ago from a ratified state,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't realize I was now coming to an unratified state. And then I was involved in a lot of social justice issues. I do a lot of pro bono work for uninsured people. I'm one of those people. You know, worked on the school board, did all that, you know, that all that kind of stuff. Was an adjunct professor, involved with social justice, all these kinds of things. Well, anyway, I realized, it came to me one day that, wait a minute, I'm in Virginia. Virginia is an unratified state. I live pretty close to the Capitol. I'm in a position to bring this information to the Virginia General Assembly and kind of bring it to their attention that they need to finish this. And I really very naively didn't think I was going to hit all this opposition. I thought I was going to bring this problem to them and say, hey, you know what? You never did this. Why don't you do it? It'd be great. And I thought they were going to say, oh, this is great. What a great, you know, public relations opportunity. I mean, I really didn't think this was going to be such a – and bam.
Yeah.
I got hit with, like, you don't even – I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy.
I can imagine,
but anyway,
yeah.
But what we did was and I had people say to me, well, you're not going to get this done. You know, the Republicans are never going to – we don't have the numbers. And I said, well, no. The road to ratification is through the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And there so I went to the General Assembly. And for 5 years now, we have passed the Virginia Senate for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We have passed the Virginia Senate with bipartisan support until this year, when they wouldn't even take it out of committee.
Right.
Because basically the toxic environment of the General Assembly this year was F you, we won. They mm-hmm. won't even talk about something that they prior supported. They wouldn't even let it out of committee. But the last 5 years we've passed in the Senate, and again, there'll be a self-correction.
Mm-hmm.
They're just feeling their oats right now. They're still doing their victory dance. But anyway, because we opened up January 11th to our session, and that's right before the inauguration. So, you know, you can consider the environment. Well, anyway, we've passed it for 5 years with bipartisan support. And the interesting thing, the Republicans that vote for it are all women. Hmm. All my Republican women are on board.
Wow.
But my Republican men are like, we don't need that. We can't. We'd love to, but we can't. And then you devolve the argument, and then sooner or later they show their hand and say something about the word about, you know, women, military, they, you know, the old tired nonsense. And I remind them that women need, in the military, need Equal Rights Amendment pretty much more than any other group at this point in time. I had a Republican woman testify at the Virginia Senate talking about, she was in Princeton ROTC graduate and served in artillery, and she testified as a military officer that it needed to be done, and that the guns that she was trained to use were mentioned in the Constitution and had more rights in the Constitution than she did. There were men on the Republican conservative men that listened to her testimony that openly laughed at her. In a way that they would never laugh. Imagine any elected official laughing at a male veteran.
Right.
This is a female veteran. He literally openly huffed, please. Just like that. In committee, it's on tape. There are so many times when I just don't know why I wasn't arrested, and that's one of them. I mean, sometimes my self-restraint really,
I can imagine.
Me.
It just makes me angry sitting here listening to you.
The last time I got that angry was in a town hall with Eric Cantor when ACA was coming out, and I was testifying about why my 7,000 uninsured patients in my clinic needed ACA, and a woman got up behind me and said, Congressman Cantor, I have breast cancer and I'm uninsured. What would you have me do? And he looked at her and said, go to her clinic.
Ugh.
I digress. So my daughters find the fact that I've developed patience to be very kind of extraordinary, but you know, it this work requires it. But anyway, so getting back to my point, we have gotten it through the Virginia General Assembly for 5 years with bipartisan support, and the women understand it, because the hard part is making these privileged grandpas, and I say to my younger activists, you're talking to your Uncle Bill. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, your Uncle Bill, you're talking to him. They're all 60. Most of them are white. They all own private businesses. They inherited the insurance company, you know, insurance sales business from their dad. They're a second generation dentist. They don't really understand. They'll tell you how nice they are to their girls in their office. They don't completely just know what you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why are we so ungrateful? They, you know, they let us take time off when we have our periods. And what's the matter with us? I mean, and really, it's really how they are. But anyway, but when we go over, we cross over. Now, the process is you go through one house, and then if it's voted on successfully, it crosses over for consideration to the other house. When it crosses over to the General Assembly, it hits the wall every time.
Yeah.
Because we have a very gerrymandered, very conservative, and the Privileges and Elections Committee chair is a man by the name of Mark Cole, who is also a Baptist deacon, very fundamentalist, and he won't let it out of committee. And he's one of the ones who said to me that he's worried about that the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, the man is not a lawyer by background. Mm-hmm. He's an ex-military guy who now has a job as some kind of county accountant, which I find kind of weird because the county that he works for lets him disappear for 2 months and go to the General Assembly and be a delegate, you know, on taxpayer dime. But that's a whole nother conversation. But he's the one who's concerned about women in clergy, and I'm like, well, that's what separation of church and state is for, but he just kind of goes around and around. He has an intrinsic biblical concern, mm-hmm. that he doesn't want his Constitution and his Bible not to agree that women are biblically in third place. You know, first God, then man, then woman. That's how they see it, and they don't want the Constitution to say anything different.
So with this third state strategy, with Nevada, Illinois, and Virginia, it doesn't mean that it's the only three states that could do it. These are just the likely three states that will do it.
Well, there are 15 states. We've got Arizona, we've got Georgia, we've got North Carolina, South Carolina. The only northern state that is not ratified is Illinois. You know, this separates along cultural lines. Now, Texas God bless Ann Richards, mm-hmm. is ratified.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, one of the reasons people say, well, why don't you start over? I'm like, are you kidding me? Now, there is a start over bill.
Yeah, I know.
But why would you do that?
Yeah.
Why would you disrespect the work of all of those women? It took us 50 years to get 35 states. Why would we start over? And not for nothing, but we'd never get Texas again.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. God bless Ann Richards. Ann Richards would rise up out of her grave and slap us across the face if we tried to do that. Now, I say my position is I'm willing to support both because to me it's a strategy that both bills are. It's like playing chess.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your king and your queen rolling down the chessboard, running interference for each other. If start over bill has to take a hit to clear the way for a three-state strategy, or a three-state strategy has to clear the way for a start over strategy, you've got two balls in play. I find that mutually exclusive. And when people say to me, oh, well, I've signed on to the three-state strategy, or I've signed on to the start over bill, I'm like, well, then if you believe the Equal Rights Amendment should be done, you should be signing on to every bill that pushes it forward. You know, right. There's more than one road to get to where we want to be, and that's the constitutional gender equality. You should support it.
So basically, I want to get to this last thing about some of the things that we can do. But as far as the three-state strategy, I want to focus on the idea that there's two approaches here. If we're able to get all those states ratified,
yep.
Then it's just a matter of Congress removing the expired deadline, correct?
You know, that's the interesting part. Now, because I live in Virginia, when I'm not in Richmond, I'm in D.C., going around talking to congressmen. And this is where they start twirling us around.
Mm-hmm.
And I go up there and I tell them, you need to remove the ratification deadline. They look at me and they go, well, bring us a freshly ratified state and we'll do it. I'm like, we can't do that. They won't ratify until you remove the deadline. That's their excuse.
Yeah, it's the catch-22.
You need to remove the excuse. And they go to me, well, we need an actionable reason. We can't just remove a deadline without an actionable reason. We need an actionable reason. I actually took Mark Cole's letter saying he couldn't do it because of the deadline and gave it to Congress people and say, this is what they're saying in Virginia. They won't do it. You're saying, so we're circling the drain. And again, it's like this big wall. They're hiding behind the minutiae of law. And again, the hardest part of this is understanding the resistance. Equality is not a bag of pennies. People, you know, when you enjoy privilege and you have a great position of privilege, equality can seem like oppression. So a lot of these people, you know, they think, well, why do women want special? Why do women want something special? No. We're not asking for anything special. We're asking to be equal to what men already have.
Yeah, and it's just equal opportunity. Like, it's not saying we're the same. It's just saying we want the equal opportunity.
And it's not a bag of gum where there's only so many pieces and once they're gone, they're gone. Equality is like love. The more you give, the more you have.
Yeah.
It's not a sum certain. It's not like, well, we've got our pile over here and you're asking us to share. No, there's plenty to go around. And the more you have, the more you get. It will multiply.
Let's cover then just real briefly. Let's go. I'm gonna hit you with a couple of things, and you can tell me, let's say you're online and you're like, hey, let's ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Someone's always gonna come and go, we don't need that because we have the 14th Amendment. So quickly tell everybody why the 14th Amendment again is not sufficient.
Well, again, I will defer to Justice Scalia, who said it wasn't sufficient,
right.
Who said the 14th Amendment was never intended to include equality for women. It was for freed black male slaves. It was the equalized racial. You know, to give us an Equal Rights Amendment would give race and gender the same constitutional scrutiny. Currently, race has constitutional scrutiny. Gender does not. I had a senator, who's very astute, female, African-American, L.A., say to me, it is really staggering to me to consider that I have more rights as a person of color than I do as a woman of color.
Mm-hmm.
And she's right. We are asking for nothing but race and gender to have the same equal. Women are the only class of humans that are not specifically included in the Constitution as being wholly and equal to every other class of humans. And you can't even say we're a distressed minority because we are the majority population. Mm-hmm. There is no way that, as Scalia pointed out, that you can rationalize that we're already there. And frankly, if 2 out of 10 justices, because Ginsburg said the same thing, she said she if she could add one more amendment mm-hmm. to the Constitution, it would be the Equal Rights Amendment. If 2 out of 10 justices, 9 now, and one is dead, but you get my point, mm-hmm. and I'm sure Gorsuch's going to go along with what Scalia said because he's an originalist, mm-hmm. it ain't there, it ain't there, it ain't there. If 2 out of 10 justices don't choose, and the others have not rendered an opinion, so I'm not even saying the other 8 say it is, because they have just not rendered an opinion that is quotable in public. But if you have the other... If you have 2 out of 10 justices saying the 14th Amendment doesn't do it, it doesn't do it. And if it's arguable that you know the 2 out of 10 say it ain't there, and that it's inferred, and some are saying it's inferred, well, inferred's not good enough. Right. You know, make right. it unequivocal.
Yes.
If justices are saying it's not there, it's not there. If we have to argue a case, a gender discrimination case, and begin by arguing whether or not gender discrimination is protected, that's a double burden on any case that's brought.
Yeah.
And in fact, they don't come. Betty Dukes, and as women gain more and more equality, it just gets worse. The Dukes versus Walmart case was a classic example. Betty Dukes, who was African-American, which is interesting only in because if she had brought this case based on race, she'd have won it. But because it was a class action case that included white women and Latina women and black women, it went in as a gender discrimination case. It got all the way, and she basically, it was about 1,750 female employees did a class action suit that said Walmart, 87% of their entry-level employees are women, and less than 2% ever get above entry-level hiring. And they said, flag on the field, this is systemic gender bias. So they put in a gender, and it was the largest discrimination case based on gender ever to hit the court. It went all the way up through to the Supreme Court level. They wanted to take it so bad because it was such a big landmark case, and they took it on the Commerce Clause, not because it didn't have a gender discrimination, because that's what it was, but there's no – in other words, you can't take a case in SCOTUS unless you can identify the constitutional principle that's being violated.
Right.
They didn't put it under the 14th Amendment. It didn't belong there. They put it under commerce. And the reason they did is it's an interstate company, world's country's largest employer. Yeah, we'll put it on commerce.
But the
problem is when it went through the Supreme Court, it failed because they couldn't make a case it was really a violation of commerce.
Right. And you can't cite, aside from that lawsuit, just in general, you can't say, oh, well, we have the Equal Protect Act of 1963 because basically there is a loophole in that which allows employers to base salaries on past earnings. So therefore, mm-hmm. if somebody were a victim of gender discrimination, pay discrimination based on gender in the past, that cycle can legally continue. And
that's just one point, though. Kimberly, the uh-huh. other point is that the Equal Pay Act of 1963 is just another intermediate law
right, with that's no baseless.
Constitutional support.
No constitutional
support. And the other interesting thing is the Economic Policy Institute, see, we have decades of data on this, and they will tell you things like, oh, well, women make different choices and blah, 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 blah. Well, the interesting thing is the Economic Policy Institute, and I want every young person to listen to this, the Economic Policy Institute that think that this is all not a problem anymore, the Economic Policy Institute grafted a male and a female first job out of college. Now, I'm not talking about an English major and a computer science major. I'm talking about a male and a female with the same degree from the same school. So if you go to the econ school at UVA, you go to Johns Hopkins and get a computer science degree. Everything's equal. Same school, same reputation, same degree. There is an 8 to 12% salary differential with the first job out of college, which is completely unexplainable. And I had an accounting professor say to me, I am tired of having a class full of students and the shining woman in the front row who's the smartest one in the class and the guy in the back who's, you know, texting on his phone the whole class and barely passes. 6 months later, I run into them and invariably the guy's got a higher paying job every single time because I'm tired of it. Now, if you take that 8 to 12% and round it out to 10% for easy math, that tells you that that's 10% a year. Like you said, that starts the train of 10% on 10% on 10% mm-hmm. on 10%. Now, you intersect that with student loan debt. Nobody's given that female a 10% discount for her gender. So that's 10% longer payout on student loans. That's a 10% higher burden on being able to handle those student loans. So what women need to do when they start asking, what is the earning ratio of this degree I'm going to get? They should start asking, what is my earning degree on this degree if I'm a woman? Because the numbers they're giving are inflated because they're mixed with the men. Mm-hmm. And this is an important thing that women need to understand this. This applies to them. And the thing is that even a law like Lilly Ledbetter, if you're able, first of all, it takes about 9 years to implement a Lilly Ledbetter Act, if you're even successful, which runs at about 15% of success. But the burden is on you. You've got to go to HR and qualify the disparities there. Good luck with that. You have to find a lawyer willing to take it. I had a college student call me once. She's madder than a wet hen because she'd gotten her boyfriend a job in the convenience store that she was working in, and she trained him. She made the introduction. She had the job. She was their best employee. He got in on her recommendation. He came home and said, "Oh, this is great. At $8.50 an hour is really going to come in handy." Well, she just about lost her mind because she was making $8 an hour. Mm-hmm. She calls me up thinking I can do something for a 50-cent an hour disparity, which is a college student's a lot of money. And she was madder than a wet hen that this happened. And I said, "What can I do?" She says. I said, "You can't do anything. No lawyer is going to take your case. If you go and complain, both you and your boyfriend are going to lose your job because every corporation says it's illegal to discuss salary. So they'll throw you out for that, even if it is pillow talk. Not going to work. You can't do anything." And that's the point. And they're not breaking the law. They're not breaking the law. There is no redress. It'd be like you not paying your taxes, filing a Lilly Ledbetter type thing against you, and then 9 years later you go, "Oh, okay, my bad. How much do I owe you?" There's no law broken. There's no penalty. There's no nothing. Where's the incentive for employers to not try? There is none.
So it's so maddening thinking about all of this. Let's wrap up here, and you tell everybody, first of all, tell everybody what's your website?
My website, which is set up as an online library. I'm an old nursing professor, so I believe information is the answer. So I'm set up as an online library. I have students doing papers from my site. So if anybody's listening is, you know, in a government class and wants to do a really cool paper, it's all there. And it's women with an E, not an A, women, hyphen, and the dash, you know, hyphen dash, women-matter.org. And the dash matters because if you don't put in the dash, you'll be routed somewhere else.
And I'm going to put that in the description area of the podcast. Right. So it will be there for everybody. And and just real brief, as we're leaving here, what can you do? Can you call congressmen, congresswomen?
You need to call. If you live in an unratified state, you need to get busy.
Okay.
And there are 15 unratified states. And again, Kimberly, you can add that later.
Yes.
You live in an unratified state, find out if there's anybody in your state doing anything and join them.
Okay.
There are people working in North Carolina. There are people working in Florida. There are people working in Arizona. There are people working in Illinois. There are people working in Nevada. Nevada right now is in a dogfight. They may actually ratify this year. There is a decision coming out of a committee today. The interesting thing is that the testimony in Nevada was like something out of the 60s. I felt into a time warp. They were arguing that women would lose widow's benefits. First of all, there is no such thing as widow's benefits. In the 70s, the government took the word women, husband and wife out. So and this is interesting because my husband's mother died when he was a child and his father was left with four children. His mother had been a bookkeeper. He got no Social Security for those four children that were orphaned by their mother, even though she had paid into Social Security. Think about that. Wow. She paid Social Security, but because she's a woman, that surviving husband who had four children to raise didn't get a thing for her. Then in 1975, of all people, Ruth Bader Ginsburg brought a case of a man whose wife died in childbirth, and he sued for the right to collect Social Security from his now dead professional wife, who had also paid into Social Security, and it won. My husband's 16-year-old sister in 1976 got 2 years of Social Security based on that, and all they had to do was change the word wife to the word spouse and change the word husband to the word spouse. But they actually went into that Nevada committee and tried to say that women were going to be left destitute because they were going to lose widow benefits. I'm like, have you people not read a book since 1972? I mean, they literally brought out the same old arguments. They started saying that it was really a secret abortion bill. The Equal Rights Amendment has absolutely nothing to do with abortion. But I understand the strategy. When you own, when you enjoy a 95% approval rating, the easiest way, the lazy way to try and tie it to something contentious like abortion is like a lazy way to try and throw a a 5-pound weight on it. But as the Yale Law Review astutely noted, you know, pregnancy is an, is a special and unique circumstance for women, and thus is not a question of equality. This is lawyer speak for men can't get pregnant. There's no equality in pregnancy. And in fact, 23 states have equal rights amendments in their state level constitutions, interestingly enough, including the state of Virginia, which is another point of ridiculousness. We have a state level equal rights amendment, but we can't pass it on the federal level, which puts us at odds with ourselves. This is why this is so circularly ridiculous. It's not even funny. But having said that, in those states that have equal rights amendments, like Virginia, the things like the Hyde Amendment go unquestioned because they do. The Equal Rights Amendment has nothing to do with choice. Nothing to do with choice. As a matter of fact, if you want to tie a, and this is where we talk about the economics, if you want to tie abortion to the Equal Rights Amendment at all, I would say it would reduce rates of abortion because the single biggest driver over decades, this is what I tell people who say, I belong to the Right to Life organization. I'm like, if you belong to a Right to Life organization, you're the first person that should be in line to support the Equal Rights Amendment because decades of data have shown that women terminate unplanned pregnancies overwhelmingly for economic reasons. If you give women economic security, economic parity, they can make enough money to take on an unplanned pregnancy, they have job security, they have equality of opportunity, they might make the choice that you so want them to make. Because invariably, those decisions are economic. And yeah. They look at me like, oh, I never thought about that. So there, but this is just the reality of life. Every woman who's ever known a woman who's terminated a pregnancy, unless it's a fetal anomaly, it's always been. And as an emergency room nurse and as a clinic nurse, I, for many, many decades, I have had many women over decades, who I say to them, sweetie, you don't have the flu. That's not a gallbladder attack. Did you know you're pregnant? If that's not happy news, they always say, I can't afford this. I can't afford this.
Well, it does always come down
exactly.
to the economy and to economics.
They're not, so while these fundamentalists are trying to say it's really a stealth abortion bill because then they come up with all the, when state level constitutional amendments prove that it's not, I say to them, if you really are so committed to reducing rates of abortion, again, I've got the answer for you. But again, it comes back to an irrational biblical concern.
So basically what we all need to do is we need to, learn about what the Equal Rights Amendment will do, and then we need to contact our congresspeople and tell them that we want it. So I just want to thank you for...
And if you live in an unratified state, get busy.
Yes, absolutely.
There's an organization in every unratified state. Find it, get on their contact list. And if you live near the capital city, get involved.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much. You have so much information and it's amazing. So that's why you're my go-to person.
It's on the website. And if anybody has any questions, click on the contact kiosk, put in a note, and I will personally answer you.
All righty. Well, thank you for joining me today, Eileen. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Kimberly. And thank you for having me.
All right. Take care.
We're going to get this done.
Yes, we will. We will persist.
Yes. Women-matter.org. Thank you.
Thank you.